You are listening to The Adventures of Saraputa and Mogalana. I'm your host, Morris Sullivan. Today, I'll share the fourth talk in the series of Things to Know to Practice Buddhism. But first, I'll tell you how Mogalana's life came to an end. As you'll recall from the last episode, Saraputa's death was relatively peaceful at his mother's home, surrounded by students and other monks. The circumstances surrounding Mogalana's death, however, were quite different. Mogalana passed away 2 weeks after Saraputa did. Both were 84 years old when they died. As you may recall, Mogalana occasionally visited celestial realms, and as the Buddha's early disciples began to age and pass away, he did this more often. He reported that many of the Buddha's devotees were reborn in the heavens, where some followers of other teachers and members of other sects, including the Jains, were not as fortunate. The leader of the Jains was named Nataputta, and when Nataputta died, conflict arose among his followers around teachings and traditions and things like that, and this conflict was exacerbated by concerns about what Mogalana was reporting back from the heavens. This internal strife cost them respect in the community, and they were losing support and supporters. Some of the Jains became very angry about this, and some of them blamed Mogalana. Well, Jains are forbidden to kill anything, so a small group of unscrupulous practitioners hatched a plan to cause Mogalana's death without themselves murdering him. They hired a gang of thugs to do it for them. Mogalana was living alone in a hut in the forest. He knew that his death was drawing near, and he was ready for freedom from the body. But as the gang approached, he decided he would use his supernormal powers to vanish. He wasn't trying to escape the pain of death so much as he was trying to spare the gang from the effects of the evil karma they would experience as a result of killing an arahant. Well, the gang arrived at his hut, didn't find him, searched for him. He was nowhere to be found. They came back the next day, same result, and this went on for several days. On the seventh day, however, Mogalana suddenly lost his ability to make his form disappear. Seems that in an earlier lifetime, he had caused the death of his own parents, and that ancient negative karma finally ripened, and he was left to face the gangsters. They found him in his hut and assaulted him brutally and then left him for dead. But Mogalana didn't die right away. He was very strong in body and mind, and he was able to regain consciousness and drag himself to where the Buddha was staying. And there, in the master's presence, he drew his last breath. So I've been doing this series on sort of what do I need to know to practice Buddhism talks.
You want to know everything.
I know, but you don't need to know everything.
We want.
Yeah, I know. I know what you want, but what you want and what you need can be different things. And the thing is, nobody can know everything. If you ever go to a Thai temple or a Laotian temple or something, they have a bookshelf by the altar that has the Pali Canon, which is the collection of teachings, the discourses the Buddha gave that have been accumulated in Pali, which is one of the languages of Buddhism, and then the rules for monastic life, and then the commentaries on all of that. And it takes up 15 feet of bookshelf space. And that's just one variety of Buddhism. So you don't have to know all of this. And so that's kind of what I've been talking about, is people come and go, where do I start? So, you know, start right here. But it's helpful to know a few things about what's going on. In fact, I was kind of noticing as we went through the service today, references to some of the stuff that I'm going to talk about, and thinking, you know, if this was your first time here and you hadn't read a whole lot about Buddhism or whatever, a lot of this, you know, evoking the Buddha's names and stuff like that, I'm sure make very little sense to you. So that's kind of part. That's part of what I'm going to talk about today, is who are all of these people that, with funny Sanskrit names and Pali names and Chinese names and stuff like that, that we talk about when we're doing the service here. And it's kind of an important topic. You don't need to know all of the bodhisattvas and Buddhas and everything. There are countless ones. But the concept is useful, and you will find times when the idea of a particular bodhisattva will touch your heart in kind of a special way. And so really just kind of want to lay the foundation for that. So one thing you need to know is that there are sort of different objectives in Buddhism. As Buddhism grew and evolved, you know, it's a living religious practice. And so the objectives of it changed over time. And initially it was to escape the cycle of rebirth altogether and become an arahant. And then, as we talked about last week, it shifted to this different ideal of becoming a bodhisattva. So you don't leave the cycle of rebirth altogether. You stick around in one way or another in order to help others become free from their suffering also. So the question might come up, what happens if you are essentially fully enlightened, but you still exist in some way to help others? Where do you do this existing, and how do you do that? So in Indian cosmology, which, you know, the Buddha came from India, so the understanding of kind of the way the worlds and dimensions and all that kind of stuff looked based on the way the ancient Indians described it. And there are heavens and hells, and there are these things that are like heavens that are called pure lands. And these places are actually constructions of the minds of awakened beings. So if I became awakened enough, I can make a pure land for people to live in. And these pure lands are pure because they don't result from any negative karma whatsoever. And if you go there, there's no way you can create any negative karma. And in fact, there's no way to not become fully liberated if you're reborn in a pure land. So that's where a lot of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas end up after they pass out of, you know, this world. They end up in one of those worlds. So there's a little difference between Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. It's kind of subtle. It sort of changes a little bit if you look at Buddhism in different parts of its history. So, you know, don't get too hung up on it. But Bodhisattvas are essentially fully liberated, but they maintain a fetter or two, a thing or two that ties them to existence in order that they can stick around. Buddhas are a little bit beyond that. So Buddhas are completely freed, and yet they move into this sort of realm of eternality that I'm not going to go into today because it's very complicated and you don't need to know right now anyway. But there's a couple of entities that, you know, that you encounter frequently here that take these different forms. So the Buddha over there, the one in the sitting position, over there in the reclining position, the baby Buddha pointing at the heavens, those are all the same person. And that was the historical Sakyamuni Buddha. That was a person who really lived about 2,500, 2,600 years ago. And that's the Buddha. When we talk about the Buddha, that's the Buddha. That was the one and only historical Buddha. But we talk about other Buddhas. So you'll hear a lot of people here say Adityafat is almost like a greeting sometimes, but it has more meaning than that. That's the Vietnamese form of the word Amitabha Buddha. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. So during our services, we recite the names of several Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And I think that these are spiritually useful to understand these and to have them here in the services. So what I want to do is just kind of introduce you to a few of the key Buddhist, for lack of a better term, divine beings. You don't need to remember all of them. And like I said, some of them will probably become significant to you at some point in your Buddhist practice. So as I said, the historic Buddha, that's Sakyamuni. This was, you'll hear him referred to as Siddhartha Gautama. He was a human being. He was born about 2,600 years ago, left his palace to go seek a way to transcend the suffering of human existence. So Buddha is not a name. Buddha is more of a title. It means awakened one. So he becomes the Buddha after his enlightenment. And if you read sometimes, especially in some of the early writings about his past, you'll hear him referred to as the Bodhisattva, or the Pali version, Bodhisatta. Same word, two different languages. And what this means is awake to become, a Buddha to be, essentially. And sometimes you'll read stories that talk about his previous existences, and you'll hear him referred to as the Bodhisattva there. And in those forms, he might be a deer or, you know, a king or something like that. But they're talking about a past life when he is this being moving toward awakening. Because of his total enlightenment, he transcended the cycle of suffering and went beyond all form. Now, that doesn't mean that he's gone. But, and this is a whole other Dharma talk, he has sort of different bodies, especially the body of enlightenment itself. So the Buddha is still present with us in the form of his teachings and in the community and in the possibility of awakening. Gautama Buddha didn't claim to be the first Buddha or even the only Buddha, just the only one associated with this particular world. So others had, in the mythology, had awakened before him in other worlds and other eras. And so some of these figures, most importantly Amitabha, predate him, at least in terms of sort of the cosmology and the explanation of that. So some of them appear in fairly elaborate and sometimes very long scriptures ascribed to the Buddha, but mostly appeared in Buddhist literature hundreds of years after his passing. So there are countless of them. But the central figure of Pure Land Buddhism, which is a very significant school of Buddhism worldwide and including here, is Amitabha, referred to in Japanese as Amida Butsu, Adidafat here. Amitabha is kind of a celestial Buddha. The name Amitabha means infinite light. He's also referred to as Amitayas, eternal life. So he is the Buddha of infinite light and life. It is basically the embodiment of oneness. And when you dig into the story of Amitabha enough, into the practice and everything, he's very much like a sort of representation of what someone like Thomas Merton might have called the ground of being or something like this. It's everything. So, but according to Pure Land scriptures, Amitabha was originally a monk named Dharmakara who made this vow that he was going to awaken to save everyone, and so he accumulated a huge amount of merit over countless lifetimes. And then he finally met this other Buddha and made this vow that he was going to create a Pure Land where anyone who sincerely said his name, in other words, anyone who really gave up their clinging to their ego in order to become one with him, could be reborn in a Pure Land, regardless of how messed up they had been in the past. You know, this idea of liberation in kind of the usual sense of becoming an arahant meant you had to make a huge amount of meritorious karma and you had to really let go of everything that attached you to anything. And so, in Mahayana Buddhism, they said we need something that real people can do, not just monks. And so Amitabha is kind of a representation of this. And so he creates this paradise. We refer to it as a Western paradise, but it's not the West. It really lies outside of anything we could consider space and time. And there's no hells, no hungry ghosts, no animals born of evil karma. Anything or anyone that lives in this land is destined for liberation. And his 18th vow was that any being who wanted to be born into this realm need only call his name with all their heart. And this is Amitabha's primal vow, makes enlightenment accessible to everyone. So another of the really well-known beings you encounter around here is Avalokiteshvara. So when you go outside and you look over by the pond and the tall figure standing by the pond, that's Avalokiteshvara. The Vietnamese name is Quan Am. You'll hear Quan Yin used, that's Chinese. Chenrezig in Tibet, Kanzeon in Japan. The name means the Lord who hears the cries of the world. So this is the embodiment of compassion. Avalokiteshvara hears our pain and responds to it. And by the way, every once in a while, somebody will ask me, is Avalokiteshvara male or female? And if I'm feeling like a smart aleck, I'll say probably. So the forms of the words can be female or male from one language to the next. And so what you end up with is something that, it, much like devas and angels in Western cosmology, can be indeterminate of gender. You might say sort of gender fluid or gender nonspecific in today's terms. So anyway, I'm going to talk a lot more about Avalokiteshvara in a couple of weeks because there's a special day that celebrates them. So in the opening of our services, I don't know whether we did it in Vietnamese today and with the bowing and everything, sometimes it's hard to read what it is that's being said. But after we bow to Sakyamuni Buddha, we bow to the future-born Maitreya Buddha. So Maitreya is a Buddha that's not here yet, but will appear in the world after the teachings have been mostly forgotten and will become Sakyamuni's successor. The name Maitreya is derived from the Sanskrit word Maitri, which is the Sanskrit equivalent of the Pali word metta. And we did the Metta Sutta. That's a Pali word that basically means, the sutra is scripture. Metta means goodwill or loving kindness. And so it's said that when Maitreya reaches awakening, all beings will at that point be freed from suffering. That's sort of the ultimate manifestation of metta. Everyone is liberated. We also talk about Manjushri. Manjushri is the bodhisattva of transcendent wisdom. It is among the oldest of the bodhisattvas in Mahayana literature. He's often depicted wielding a flaming sword, which symbolizes cutting away ignorance and dualistic thinking. And in his left hand holds a copy of a sutra and a lotus, which symbolizes the blossoming of realization. Sometimes shown sitting on a blue lion or a lion's skin, which represents the use of wisdom to tame the mind. Samantabhadra is another important one. This is the bodhisattva of great action or great practice. Personifies the idea that wisdom is only really useful if you do something with it, if you put it into practice. So he's often depicted riding a large elephant, which I think we could interpret to symbolize the strength of commitment and diligence in practice. He's prominent in a very large, pretty important sutra called the Flower Garland Sutra, where he makes 10 great vows. And those vows really become kind of a blueprint for Buddhist practice, to pay homage and respect to Buddhas, to praise Sakyamuni Buddha, to be generous, to repent bad deeds and evil karmas, rejoice in the merits and virtues of others, ask those who attain enlightenment to continue teaching, ask bodhisattvas to remain in the world and help others, follow the teachings of the Buddha at all times. Basically, it's what we do in our service. His vows are pretty much reflected in all of that stuff that we say, at 10 o'clock in the morning on Sundays. Mahastramaprada is one of my favorites because I really like saying that name, Mahastramaprada. It means great power. He's among those who reached enlightenment through the recitation of Amitabha's name. And so he's prominent in the Pure Land Sutras. Another of my really useful ones in terms of emotionally connecting to these things, these beings, is Ksitigarbha. This is the Bodhisattva of great aspiration. Ksitigarbha is known for his vow to take responsibility for the instruction of all beings born between the death of Sakyamuni and the appearance of Maitreya. So, in that sense, we owe the fact that we're here getting instruction to Ksitigarbha. But he's also kind of like a patron saint of those in hell, because he made another vow. There's a really interesting story about how he was reborn in hell, kind of accidentally, but he decided he would keep coming back because he felt so badly for the hell beings suffering in hells that he decided he would keep coming back to hell until the hells were empty. He is usually depicted as a monk with a halo, carrying a staff, which he uses to open the gates of hell, and a jewel to light up the darkness. That's the little statue over there at the altar where we make offerings on behalf of departed ancestors, is Ksitigarbha. In Japan, he's known as Jizo, and he's a very popular Japanese divinity. He's kind of the guardian of children and the souls of infants and unborn children and that sort of thing. There's a reference in the prostrations that we do to Dharma protectors. And there's a number of Dharma protectors. One of them I want to mention, his name is Achala. The Japanese name is Fudo, and he's a good example. You often see this figure with kind of a wrathful face, carrying a sword and a lariat and engulfed in flame. I like him. He is a very powerful deity who protects all beings by burning away things that keep us from getting enlightened. And so this is a sort of image of this strength and power, is really like, this is the kind of help we need sometimes on the spiritual path. Our impediments to enlightenment can sometimes be very strong. And, Avalokiteshvara far as wonderful, but sometimes we need somebody with a flaming sword. At least I do. I don't know, maybe not you. So often I get asked by people will come up and say, oh, you're a Buddhist? Why do you guys worship this fat person? You've all seen the Buddha at the Chinese restaurant, right? So that's not the Buddha. The confusion is understandable because the name in some languages is Budai, which sounds like the same thing. Sometimes he's equated to Maitreya in some traditions. He's also known by his Japanese name, Hotei. And in Japan, he's kind of a representation of contentment. He's known in folklore for being very happy and very, very kind. Rubbing his belly can bring good luck in some traditions. According to Chinese history, he was a Chan monk, a Zen monk, who lived during the 10th century AD. And his name, Budai, actually means cloth sack. And he was considered kind of eccentric, but very good and loving. He was known to care for children and hand out candy to people. So he's a little bit like the Buddhist Santa Claus. So these are the ones that you encounter a lot and you encounter in our services here. And people will sometimes ask me, are these bodhisattvas real? Should I believe in them? So it's a mistake to confuse truth with facts. And I'm not, I'm not saying we don't have to believe reality, we do. But there are things that contain great spiritual truths, but be of somewhat doubtful historic authenticity, but that doesn't really matter when it comes to spiritual stories. Somebody said, do you think Ivalo Kitteshvara is real? And I said, well, do you think compassion's real? Well, yeah. Do you think compassion can transform you? Do you think you receive compassion? I mean, you're here. You know, there's people who support this, created this, so that others can come here and study Buddhism and, you know, better their lives and be freed from a lot of their stress and suffering. That's compassion reaching out to you. And we learn with our practice that as we develop compassion and extend compassion to others, we become happier people and freer people ourselves. So acting compassionately also liberates us. And so as the embodiment of compassion, we are Avalokiteshvara. Like I said, we're going to talk about this more later. But, you know, Avalokiteshvara is often represented as having thousands of arms and eyes. Well, how can one being have thousands of arms and eyes? By working through us, you know. So being one with a bodhisattva is kind of a way of looking at this. You know, I can be one with Fudo and restrain my cravings with the lariat. My practice can be like a fire burning away greed or anger. You need faith to do this kind of thing, but that doesn't mean believing in something that's outside of you. It means embodying your faith in your actions. The way our practice embodies our Buddha nature, which is, I'm going to wrap up this series next week by talking about what that means. Earlier I mentioned when Samantabhadra makes these great vows. And the sutra explains where this happens, explains that bodhisattvas are beyond the concept of coming and going. And thus they transcend the scope of dualistic thinking. The idea that there's me and there's you and those are different things. That there is and there isn't and those are different things. The sutra says, if I wish to see Amitabha Buddha in his world of happiness, then as soon as I formulate the intention to see him, I see him. At the same time, I can clearly see all the various Buddhas in their lands with their retinues, as well as their spiritual powers. And yet, these bodhisattvas do not come here, nor do I go there. All Buddhas are like the moon reflected in the water. There is only one moon, but its image appears in countless drops of dew. So I hope that this was helpful, and that when you're saying, you know, reciting the Buddha's names and that kind of stuff, that this will maybe resonate with you a little bit. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for joining me for another episode of The Adventures of Sariputta and Moggallana. I hope this discussion of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas was helpful to you and that you will develop your own vows to awaken. I'll wrap up the Things You Need to Know in Order to Practice Buddhism series next week. In the meantime, go save the world.